it's a real colour for inviting me here. It's a really nice place. And everything is nearly perfect at the perimeter, except that maybe the air condition has some problems with my thought. But otherwise, everything's fine. I present you a work on which I've been working during the two or three last years. It's between quantum information and quantum foundation. The first remark to present the results is that in many applications in quantum information, there is often a symmetry between the states in which the information is encoded. And for instance, if you think to the BB84 protocol, we could permute the role played by the qubit 0 and 1 without changing everything to the efficacy of, to the efficiency of the protocol. So that's the beginning point. I will consider groups of permutations of states that belong to the same basis in Hilbert space, and I will build all my program on the basis of those symmetries. And those symmetries are very natural in many applications in quantum information. And for instance, the simplest case, I consider the qubit case, and there are two possible permutations between two objects. There is the identity, where I don't do anything, and then I can permute 0 and 1. And there is a unitary operator that makes this permutation, and actually this is the sigma x poly operator. And so, just looking at the permutation, I already derived two operators, the sigma x operator and also the identity. And the next step is to diagonalize the sigma x operator. I find the eigenbasis that's here. And I can play the same game with the new states here. I can permute them, and if I make a very short computation, I will find that the permutation between the two eigenstates of sigma x is actually the sigma z operator. And now the last step is that I can take product of sigma z and sigma x, and I will find something proportional to sigma y. And so just looking at the symmetries, I can derive the poly group. So I can derive a finite group with four unitary operators, the identity, and the three poly operators. And this I will generalize later to higher dimensions. There are very useful properties. There are already plenty of things that I can do with this little group. for instance, what I can do is that I look at the structure of subgroups inside the poly group, and I have three subgroups that consist at each time of the identity and one of the sigma operators. And what I can do, those subgroups are commuting, I can find a common eigenbasis of the operators of my subgroup. And I found three bases that have a nice property, they are mutually unbiased. So they are maximally complementary. And by definition, in dimension D, two bases are said to be mutually unbiased if the modulus square of the in product of states that belong to two mutually unbiased bases, this in product is always equal to 1 divided by the dimension. And in particular, in dimension 2, I have that the in product the square of the product is equal to 1/2, which means that if I prepare one state, for instance, in the computational basis, the probability of transition to states that belong to this basis, this probability of transition is 50-50. So I will have the same probability if I make, for instance, a Sternkellogg measurement to find a state up along x and a state down along x when I prepare a state up along z. And this is exactly the probability that I would get if I would toss an unbiased coin. And this is the origin of the name mutually unbiased. So I have homogeneously distributed probabilities if I look at transition between states that belong to two mutually unbiased spaces. Another property of the displacement operators is that they are in one-to-one correspondent with the Bell states, and you can see it here. To each of my displacement operators, I can associate a two-qubit state just by replacing a bra by a ket. I will pass from these operators to those states. And as you know, the Bell states have plenty of application quantum information, for instance, teleportation, cloning, and so on. They are also maximally entangled. and they form an orthonormal basis of the four-dimensional Hilbert space, two qubits. Now, I have also something like that for my operators. If I consider the trace norm product, the poly operators form a basis of the linear operators, and this presents direct applications in tomography. Actually, any qubit density matrix can be expressed as a linear superposition of my displacement operator, and the parameters that appear here, they have plenty of applications in physics. For instance, in LMR, they are called the block parameters, and in optics, they are the Stokes-Poincaré parameters that are massively used in polarimetry. And in order to estimate those parameters, the most straightforward manner to make the tomography of a quantum state is to measure the transition probabilities in the three mutually unbiased bases that correspond to the two operators here. And so, related to those operators, there is also a straightforward way to make tomography of an unknown quantum state. This tomographic procedure is optimal in the sense that there is no redundancy between the data that are collected in different bases because the bases are mutually unbiased. Another remark is that because those bases are mutually unbiased, they are also massively used in quantum cryptography, because if a spy makes a measurement in one of the bases, he has no information at all about the signal that will be encoded in another basis. Yes?
If you can be more optimal than NUB because you have only UV less data.
Yes, in a sense, but we can talk about QPMs. If you just look at bottom up measurements, then the best way to make tomography. Now, if you consider POVMs, I will mention this a bit later. symmetric information complete POVMs are also optimal. Here it's true that you lose, every time you make a measurement, you must normalize. So you lose one parameter. But otherwise, if I just limit myself to von Neumann measurement, that's the best way to make tomography. and I come to the second point. If you look at, for instance, at BB84 protocol, the signal is encoded in mutually unbiased bases. Also something else in quantum cryptography. If Alice and Bob use all the mutually unbiased bases, they can make full tomography of the quantum state. this is good because this imposes maximal constraint on the spy who would eavesdrop the communication. And so that's another reason for making use of information incomplete measurements during quantum cryptography. And now we'll show how it's possible to generalize all these to higher dimensions. So those properties of qubits are, I think, are very well known. But it's interesting to look at higher dimensions. And for instance, the dimension 4 is interesting. In this case, there are many possible permutations between my four basis states. There are 24 permutations. I will restrict myself to two interesting groups of permutation between the four basis states. And these are the cyclic group that contains the identity and the three cyclic permutation that are given here. And there's also an interesting group of permutation, the Galois group. I will explain a bit later why I call it the Galois group. that contains the identity and also the permutation that are given here. I can represent this schematically very simply. The cyclic group, it consists of the identity and the four permutations that are given here. So these are my four basis states. So this is the cyclic group of permutation between four objects. And the other group, the Galois group, consists of the identity and then such symmetries. So this is the group that I listed here. And when I know those groups of permutations, I can define operations like addition and multiplication that are just based on this permutation. And to derive the addition, I just make use of the rule that is given here. And this defines me addition tables that are given here. So this is the addition table that corresponds to the cyclic permutations, and this is the addition table that corresponds to those operations. For instance, you see that I have zero on the diagonal, and that's related to the fact that the square of those permutations is always equal to the identity. Now that I have my addition table, I can also find a multiplication by imposing that the multiplication is distributive relatively to the addition. And so I find here the cyclic multiplication, and I find here the Galois multiplication. And it's easy to check that the cyclic operations are nothing else than the operations modulo 4. Now, the algebraic structure that I get with those operations, so I have an addition that is commutative, commutative multiplication that is distributive relatively to the addition. This is what is called a ring. And with the Galois operation, there is an extra property, is that if I look at the multiplication table here in this corner, so I don't consider zero, I see that there is no divider of zero except at zero itself. And this property, if I have a ring where there is no divider of zero except at zero, this is what is called a field. And it was studied by Galois in the 19th century. So this is why I call those operations Galois operations. And I always represent them this way with this is the Galois addition and this is the Galois multiplication. Just by looking at those operations, actually, I can define a group of unitary operators that generalize the qubit displacement operators to higher dimensions. My displacement operators are given here. So this is a kind of translation inside the computational basis, where I use the Galois addition to pass from one state to the other. And it can be shown that this operation is a translation in the Fourier-Galois dual space, so which is relatively to the computational basis, a complementary basis that plays the same role as the impulsion representation relatively to the position representation. And so these operators, they can be shown to form a group that has plenty of interesting properties here. I forgot to mention the gamma here is related to the dimension of the space where I work. And actually, this construction works only in prime power dimensions. And then this phase is the p root of unity. And in that case, the dimension is a prime number, so p is a prime number with an integer power, so the dimension d is equal to pp to the power m, where m is a positive integer, and p is a prime number. And so, yes?
Multiplication, what is the addition? One of them was the composition, just there, of two permutations, right?
So, so I look at certain permutations. Okay.
Page of permutation, you had a definition.
If I look at this group of permutations,
right. So and the
I can derive from the composition now I can derive an addition. And actually this is my symmetry is from the commuting group, so the addition will also be commutative.
We had a proof, and the proof was a proof under multiplication, right?
No, or no, I didn't talk about multiplication before. The composition of those symmetries, yes. So for instance, if you compose this and that, you will get that.
Right.
And this in my table, it means that something like 1 plus 2 is equal to 2. If you take the square of this symmetry, if you iterate it twice, you will get the identity, which is labeled by zero with this convention. And you see that the square of all my operators here is equal to the identity.
It's funny if you take square and you refer to
as an addition, right? Wouldn't you rather say twice the...
Okay, it's a bit confusing, but you can forget it for what follows. It's just a way to introduce those... Yes, something else. It's defined. So you look at some validations, and you can define the addition this way.
Papers are now for the cycle group and for the Gallo and basic for the two different groups that you're doing. So basically, just the second is just a kind of shortcut if you.
Okay.
But then what was the
multiplication?
Right.
So that was the first step of my addition. And then I look at tables where I will have distributivity. So the multiplication will be distributive relatively to the addition, which means that A times B plus C is equal to A times B plus A times C. And then if I solve this problem, I find the tables that are given here.
Yes, it's something new. Basically, at the moment, you just define the table.
Yeah, just look at the table, and later we'll forget about this. All what interests me is the addition and the multiplication. And I will go out with those positions. But I wanted to stress the point that is related to natural symmetries of the Hilbert space. Yes?
By Rothler and a coworker.
Yeah, many people have been working on this kind of.
So they have some construction. It's this trace function on the field.
Yes, it's related to a Galois field. Yeah.
Is that sort of generated a difference that when we started to
talk about? Essentially, yes. And it was already done, I will mention the reference, it was already done by Wouters and Field in 89. But what is new here is maybe this this notation and this way to arrange all the operators. Because there are several manners to have arrived to the same result. But so now I can define those operators that are well defined when I know my field. one more remark is that when the dimension is prime, then all these operations are very simple. And actually, they're reduced to the modulo D operations, and D is a prime number in that case. There are some useful identities. One can show that with the choice for the phase that I did here, that's well shows in function of the dimension, I have a kind of cyclic constellation of those powers. So this is the first identity which is very useful to carry out computations. And I have also this relation. So this seems to be trivial because we know that if I take the product of two phases, so this is the complex product. Here I will add that this is first field because this is an exponential expression. And this will be the addition between real numbers, or in this case, those are integer numbers. But what I wrote there, it's not the same because here I have the Galois addition. So this is a special property that is also useful for carrying out computations. There is something else that I can remark about my addition, is that the addition factorizes. For instance, if I look at the table that I had before with my four elements here, and that I assume that this represents qubits. So I have two qubits and I'm in a four-dimensional space. It's easy to check that this table factorizes into two additions modulo two. And this is what I've written here. the Galois addition factorizes to the addition modulo two of my two qubits. And this is very general. In dimension Pn, so when I have n qubits, where P is a prime, the addition of my Galois field factorizes to the local additions modulo P for each of my components. For the multiplication, it's quite more complicated, actually. The multiplication table is not an easy task in general to derive it, but this has been solved by mathematicians since a long time, and so if one really needs to know the multiplication table, it's not complicated to find it, for instance, on the web. Everything is available for the users. Now, one extra remark. All what I said now was about the Galois operations, but there are certain properties that are also true for the modular operations. For instance, if I consider the modular addition and multiplications, those identities are also true. In that case, I must make a different choice for my phase. And in prime dimension, the Galois and modulo d operations coincide, as I said before. And because of that, there are certain properties that I can formulate with both groups. So as well with the Galois operation and the cyclic operation, I can, for instance, give a generalization to teleportation and dense coding to higher dimensions. And actually, if I define the Bell states just by taking my displacement operators and changing a broad to a ket as I did before, I arrive to the following definition for Bell states. It's easy to prove the two identities that are given here. And this contains actually teleportation, and this is the equation of dense coding. So I will not insist on that, but for instance, you see here that if Alice sends a certain QD state to Bob, and that Bob is entangled with Charles, they are in this Bell state. Then, if Alice and Bob make a measurement of their John, their two qubits in the Bell basis, this will project the state of Charles onto the unknown state up to a displacement operator, and this is the essence of teleportation. And you have the same for dense coding. So this is something that you can realize with different definitions of the Bell states. You can either use the Galois operations, but also the modular operations. Now, if you want to derive mutual unbiased bases, this will only work when you use the Galois operations. This you can check just by construction. If you use the other operation, you will not be able to derive the mutual unbiased bases. And the technique actually to derive the mutual unbiased bases, like for the qubit case, you take the group of displacement operator, you look at the commuting subgroups, and they are given by those expressions, you diagonalize the commuting subgroups and you find bases that are mutually unbiased. And this is as a consequence that the construction of a maximal number of mutually unbiased bases, d plus 1, only works for certain dimensions. The reason for that is that it has been proven at the beginning of the 20th century that finite fields with d elements exist only when d is equal to the power of a prime. So this doesn't work in all dimensions. And for instance, with this approach, I found the following expression for the mutual unbiased basis. This is in O prime power dimensions. In even prime power dimensions, I have something like that. Actually, it's more complicated because there is also a fundamental difference between the even dimensional finite fields and odd dimensional finite fields. It's a bit a pity because in quantum information people use qubits. So when I have m qubits, I am in an even dimensional finite field. And everything is more complicated in that case, but it's still possible to solve the problem. If the dimension is not the power of a prime, then the problem is still open. For instance, in dimension 6, nobody knows whether it will be possible to derive 7 mutual unbiased bases. Nobody never ever found an expression for them. And nobody also knows how many mutual unbiased bases it's possible to derive. The best that was done until now is 4 mutual unbiased bases. So this is an open problem. Nobody knows how to solve this question. So because the mutual unbiased basis can be derived on the infinite power dimensions. There are also specific applications of those techniques that will work specifically for those dimensions. For instance, the first thing that we can do is quantum tomography, and this directly generalizes the qubit tomography. Just by measuring the transition probabilities in all the mutual unbiased bases, one can determine all the parameters of the density matrix. And for instance, if I do that in the qubit case, I will find the block coefficients or the Stokes-Poincaré coefficients that determine my density matrix. Another application I will take some time on it is that making use of those properties and those techniques, it's possible to find a solution for the Minkings problem in prime power dimension. Actually, this problem was formulated in 87 by Weidman and Aronoff in dimension 2. And the problem was the following. I didn't write the little story here, but Alice is on a ship with Bob, and then there is a storm, the ship sinks. Alice swims to the beach. Bob is eaten by sharks, so she's alone. And she arrives on an island where there is a very cruel king, a mean king, who doesn't like quantum physicists. And so he imposes a challenge to Alice. And the challenge is the following. She can prepare a spin 1/2 atom in a certain state. So she has a lab with all facilities. She can carry out any quantum measurement or operation that she wants. She's only limited by the laws of quantum mechanics. So she must prepare a spin 1/2 atom in a given state. Then, after the preparation, the kings will enter into the lab and he will measure the spin along x, y, or z. But she will be absent. She has not the right to look at the result. But then, after the king has performed the measurement, she can come back in the lab and make, again, any measurement that she wants. And she must be able to guess what is the result of the spin measurement that the king obtained in her absence. And she must guess this correctly, because the rule of the game is that if she fails to guess it correctly, she will be killed at once. And every day, this challenge will be repeated. So it's her interest to find really a solution to the problem that will allow her to guess with certainty one result of the spin. A priori, this seems to be an impossible task, because those are non-commuting bases, and it seems to be impossible to guess simultaneously the result of the spin measurement along those three directions. And actually, there is a way to solve the problem. So the naive way to solve the problem is to use only one atom, and then indeed it's not possible to solve the problem with 100% efficiency. Actually, if Alice will prepare only one spin 1/2 atom, the best that she can do is the strategy that is described here. So what she could do is to prepare, before the king makes the measurement, to prepare the state, to polarize the spin along a certain direction, for instance, z. And then if the king performs the measurement, she will know the result, because she has prepared the spin along z. But if the king measures along x and y, then it will disturb the spin. And in that case, it will project, for instance, if the spin was measured along z up, and that the king measures along x, then it will either project it along x up or x down. Or if he measures along y, it will project the initial state along y up or y down. And so in that case, Alice must be able to discriminate between those four states that are on the equator of the Bloch sphere. So this is x up, x down, y up, y down. It's impossible to do that, to discriminate them perfectly. The optimal strategy is to make a measurement along an intermediate basis, for instance, along this basis, or equivalently along that basis. And then she can infer the value of the spin with a probability equal to cosine square of 22.5 degrees, which means that in average, she will guess correctly the result obtained by the king with a probability 1/3, that's when the king measures along z, plus 2/3 times 0.85, and that's very close to 0.9. So in that case, the best that she can do is guess the result with probability 0.9, and that's very bad if the king repeats the challenge day after day. This is like playing Russian roulette with a gun with one bullet and nine empty holes, and after something like 10 days, the probability that she survives is very low. So it's of interest to find another solution for the problem, and this solution was found by Weimann and Aharonov. Actually, what I did was first to rewrite this solution in terms of the Bell states. The trick here is that Alice will not prepare only one atom, but she will prepare two atoms. And she will prepare two entangled atoms along this Bell state. So there is one atom that she will give to the king, and one atom that will remain in the corner of the lab, and that she will use afterwards. And there is a nice property for the Bell states. They have a kind of covariance property. When they are expressed in different mutual unbiased bases, they still remain Bell states. So this is the transformation law for my Bell states. If I express them in the Z basis, I will have the states that are given here, but they are still Bell states when I express them in function of the X and Y states. If, for instance, the king measures the state here along in the Z basis, he will project it either on this state or on that state with probability 1/2, 1/2. But when he measures it in the other basis, because this state is this nice invariance property, he will again project it along one of those states. So the problem is different now. Alice is a larger Hilbert space, it's four dimensions instead of two, and instead of discriminating between four states like there, she must discriminate between the six product states that are given here, and it's possible to carry out this type efficiently with efficiency 100%. So how could she discriminate between these six product states? The trick is that she will make a measurement into a basis of the four-dimensional state that is given here. So a certain combination of the Bell state. And you can check easily that, for instance, let's say that the first detector fire. This state contains those combinations of Bell states. And the Bell state 0,0 is written here, the Bell state 0,1 is written there. The other Bell state just contain states of the form 1 times 0 or 0 times 1. And that's not relevant here, because if you look at the preparation that will occur during the measurement of the king have only products of states of this kind 0,0 or 1,1. And so, for instance, if the first detector fires, this is a symmetric combination of B0,0 and B0,1. So this is actually orthogonal to 1,1, because 1,1 disappears from the expression here. And so if the first detector fires, Alice knows with certainty that if the king measured in the Z basis, he obtained the result 0. And so she can infer what was the result of the measurement obtained by the king. And if you look at those states, I have an anti-symmetric combination here, so she will infer that the result was 1. And if I now make use of the transformation law that is given here, the reasoning is still valid for the two other bases. So also for the direction X and Y, I can make the same reasoning, and so it's possible to infer what was the result obtained by the king. And this can be generalized in higher dimensions. Actually, with the definition of the Bell state that I gave, if I pass from the computational basis to another mutually unbiased basis, I have this transformation law. So this is the covariance property of the Bell states. I can repeat all the procedure. Alice will prepare the state in the Bell, the original state in the two-atom state, which is the Bell state 0,0. And then to discriminate between all the results obtained by the king, she will make a measurement in this basis. This is a bit technical. This is the Galois extension of the Galois product that I introduced before. And this can be obtained in the same manner that I can pass from the field of real number to the field of complex number by adding an extra element and by imposing that I have a field, arrive to such a structure. so that was my second application, solution of the Minkowski problem in five-order dimensions, and it's directly related to a definition of the Wigner distribution in five-order dimension. As I said before, I can pass from displacement operators to Bell states just by changing a Bragg bracket, and here I can do the same. If I look at this basis that I gave here, which is an interesting basis because it's full of nice symmetries, if I change the Bell state to a displacement operator, instead of a double qudit state, I will get a qudit linear operator. And the operator that I get is actually all the properties of the discrete Wigner operator. So to the solution, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the solution of the Minkowski problem and Wigner operators in prime power dimensions. I recall some properties of the Wigner distribution. In order to derive a good candidate for a Wigner distribution, I must find operators that have translational invariance under the displacement operators. I have some normalization property. I have a property about the marginals, that if I consider the straight lines in my phase space, in my discrete phase space in this case, so instead of having Q and P, now I have, instead of continuous variables, I have discrete variables, and these labels, for instance, the states of the computational basis, and this labels the states of the discrete Fourier transform of that basis. I have that the sum of my Wigner operators along straight lines in my phase space must be equal to a projector onto a state. And actually, there is a property here that I have d plus one different directions for my straight lines. And each direction corresponds to one of my mutual unbiased bases. So this is a property that I can require for my discrete Wigner distribution. Actually, all this was done by Wouters some years ago. And one can check that with the definition that I gave here of the Wigner operators, all these conditions are fulfilled. And I give you an example for the simplest case, which is the dimension 2. I can solve the constraint, actually. For instance, I impose the normalization of my Wigner operators. I make use of the marginal property. So in this case, I am in a discrete space, which is 2 by 2. I, for instance, that the sum of the Wigner operators here along those two straight lines is a projector on two states of the computational basis. If I take the sum like that, I have projector on the Eigen basis of sigma x. And if I take my straight lines like this, I will find projectors on the Eigen state of the sigma y basis. so this is what I have expressed here. I have some freedom in the choice for the projector. So this could be the projector on the up state, and then this is the sum of those is the projector on the down state. But I'm free to choose to assign up and down. So I could say up down or down up. It doesn't change. It's just another constraint. For instance, if I choose that the straight lines here correspond to the states up, this will rise all ambiguity about my Wigner function, and combining the constraints, I will find that the Wiener function is the Wiener operator or something like this, and the Wiener distribution is the average values of those operators. And one here I express this in function of the block parameters. One can say directly that this Wiener distribution is in one-to-one correspondent with the solution of the main Kings problem, because the Bell states correspond to the displacement of the wave. So this is an example where I show how it works. And this actually has been measured with NMR systems in China and also by people at the University of Singapore. So it's possible to measure the qubit Wiener distribution by making a symmetric informationally complete POVM. So there is a POVM that will give directly up to an additive constant. It will give me all the Wiener factors or the Wiener amplitudes. And recently, the team in Singapore has also measured the Wiener distribution of two qubits. And this is done by taking two entangled states and carrying out thick POVM measurements at each side in the local qubit. So, I don't know how much time it remains. 15 minutes, something like that. You have no questions? Yes?
In the operator in the continuum, the next page.
I don't remember it, but it looks.
This expression is close to the one that I found in the discrete case. But just you replace discrete variable by continuous variable. It has the same aspect. But I don't know. No, I don't know it. Yeah.
You can find a project, or you can find a separate zone operator for which this will be the perspective.
You take x and you put plus or minus delta before you transform it to delta. Get rho of x, x prime, and then let it, you subtract x on one side and add, you subtract delta on one side of x, x prime, and you replace it by x prime plus delta. Then you integrate over d delta, you got px.
Yeah, so that's
it might be easier to think about the expectation value of the displacement operator, the e to the i, but the x plus b with some coefficients, and then the Fourier. Yes.
What's up?
What
Ray said was the Wiener distribution. But he's saying that there's an operator whose expectation value is that distribution.
Yes, because
so I'm asking what is that operator.
As he said,
I don't know if what you said is that operator.
You have the average value of the displacement operator, okay? So in my notation, something like this. And then you have like the Fourier transform of it. So you would, in the continuous case, you would write A prime A. I'm not sure about the sign and could be something like that. So this is the continuous definition, something of that style. And this is the displacement operator in the continuous case. If you look at what I got here, so if you turn this into an operator, this will correspond to the displacement operator. Well, we have some phase factor that ensures that actually this will be a self-adjoint operator. And then you have this Fourier transform at the beginning. So it's the equivalent of the continuous case, but instead of having the usual multiplication and addition between real numbers, you will have another field, and in this case it is a discrete field that is given. Okay? So now we'll pass to something else. I don't know who here has been working on the epistemic interpretation. Listen, maybe. Because before I came here, I read this paper of Rob Speckens that is not here today. And there are some connections between this construction and the epistemic interpretation. Maybe that you work on a film that you were mentioned at the end of the paper, but I don't know what it was. Chris. I saw your name, I saw Chris Fuchs and Lucian Hardy were tagged at the end of the paper.
Well, I have to say I'm joking. Okay. And then you said epistemic, and I won't
So, what's the guy's not here today? Actually, you can tell him that it's forbidden to do the historic interpretation in arbitrary conditions. It's very actually, if I look at the labels of those Wigner localization operators in phase space, I can organize them so like it was here. So I have D labels for my discrete position and D labels for my discrete impulsion. And so this makes a discrete phase space that consists of D square points. And when I have a Galois field, there is a natural structure that will appear. There is a structure related to the straight lines. So for instance, as I said, for the Wigner distribution, there is a marginal property that the sum of the Wigner operators along the straight line is equal to a projector of an element of a mutually unbiased basis. Actually, the structure of the straight line, this is given just by linear equation in my discrete space. So this is the equation of a straight line in two dimensions with the usual notations. But in my case, I will have, so if I consider points M, N, M and N vary from 0 to B minus 1. The equation of a straight line is something like M is a certain element of my Galois field. This is the Galois product, and this is the Galois addition. So this defines the structure on my finite phase space. There is this geometrical correspondence. When I'm in prime power dimensions, there is a geometrical correspondence between the mutual unbiased basis and sets of parallel lines. And for instance, I have the property that two non-parallel lines will intersect in only one point. And this is a property of affine geometry that is preserved at this level. And there is also something I can do. I can associate certain questions to my Wigner operators. And what I will see is that, for instance, if I look at the projector here and that I prepare a state that belongs to a mutually unbiased basis that does not correspond to this direction, then I will have a probability 1 divided by d that my detector will fire when I ask this question. And otherwise, if I prepare my state in a state of the same mutual unbiased basis, and that will correspond to a distinct direction, the probability to fire is 0, because my bases are orthonormal. this structure actually is the same basic structure on which the epistemic interpretation is built. I will not say much about this interpretation. It's a kind of toy theory where one does not need to define an Hilbert space or all that machinery. All what is required is to have some set of questions. And actually, there are d square plus d questions and d square plus d states. For each state, there will be d deterministic questions for which the answer will be yes or no. And d square and deterministic question for which the answer will be given with probability 1 divided by d. So the answer yes will be will appear with probability 1 divided by d. Well, I didn't write this here, but if you make the average between knowledge and uncertainty, actually the knowledge and the ignorance about the state are equal because d times 1. So for d questions, I have certainty 1. And for d square question, I have uncertainty 1 divided by d. And those two quantities are equal. So in principle, it's not necessary to introduce a Hilbert space. But nevertheless, just with this structure, there are plenty of ways to mimic
interesting properties of quantum states, like for instance, it's possible to mimic what corresponds to mutually unbiased bases. This is obvious after my talk, I think, but also uncertainty relations, no cloning, and things like that.
Generalization of Rob's 20
model. Yes.
That's where you
okay. Did it for dimension 2 and 4,
which are the two cases that I considered here with my permutations. But now what I want to say is that actually this limitation that I mentioned about the dimensionality, that the dimension must be a prime power, this is also true for the epistemic interpretation. So not all dimensions are permitted. So the epistemic toy theory of Rob Speckles, I will limit myself to that. So with those questions that are sometimes deterministic, sometimes not, and the number of questions is related to a parameter that's called a dimension.
And the way you talk about the knowledge balance principle
yes.
is like you did.
Okay.
No, my point is that actually, if one wants to generalize this toy theory to higher dimensions, to other values of D, so this was done in the paper of Rob just for dimension 2 and 4, one must find a structure which is actually an affine structure. So I will have sets of parallel lines and different directions for the parallel lines. Two non-parallel lines must intersect in only one point. So this is a consequence of the construction. You cannot avoid that. This structure is called actually a finite affine plane. So a collection of these square points with those properties. And it has been shown actually that such structures do not exist for dimension 6 and 10. It is conjectured by mathematicians who work on finite geometries that, that those structures only exist for prime power dimensions. But this has not been proven. And I will give an idea of how it's possible to prove that. Actually, the proof for dimension 6 was obtained at the beginning of the 20th century in 1900. And this proof was obtained in the 90s, and this required a lot of computer power. I'm not sure, maybe they reach also dimension 12. But there is no proof for higher dimensions because the time for the computation increases exponentially, and so it's too long to be computed with prismatic computers. And it is actually a funny story. the non-existence of such affine planes is related to a conjecture of Euler. So that was, I'm not sure, 17th or 18th century. It's related to what's called the problem of the 36 offices. And it's a problem of combinatorics. You have 36 officers, and they come from six different regiments. So from each regiment, there are six officers that have also different ranks. And they are put together, I don't know, there is a kind of, they gather at the headquarters like people do, like army does usually once a year. There's some exercises. The goal is to optimize the contact between officers from different regiments and different ranks. And the problem is the following. Is it possible to let them sleep in six different rooms? So in each room there are six beds. And also to let them eat at six different tables, such that in each room there are officers of different ranks and regiments, and also around the table there are officers that come from different regiments and different and have different ranks, but also slept in different rooms in order to optimize all the contacts between these officers. Yes.
Is this related to the existence of a design of
blocks?
Yes. So that was the problem with which Euler was concerned at that time. And people had no television, so they tried all possible ways to arrange the officer. They spent hours and hours, and so Euler spent a lot of time to try to find a solution. And nobody found a solution. So Euler conjectured that there was no solution. This was finally proven in 1900 by a French custom officer, his name is Tariq. He was living in Algeria in the desert, he was working there at the custom, and he had nothing to do. So he tried all combinations during many years, and finally showed that there was no solution for the problem. I found this on the web. It's written in French, but I think you can understand. So that's the formulation in old French of the problem of Euler. And you can represent it this way. Actually, you have this matrix. Each couple here of indices will correspond to an officer. For instance, this is the rank 4 for the officer from the 4th region. You want to put all these 36 officers in this matrix, and this will correspond to different tables. So the horizontal lines will correspond to the tables, and the vertical lines will correspond to the rooms. And this is an example where you try to solve the problem, but at the end you cannot do it. So you see that, for instance, in a given room, there are officers that come from different regiments because, for instance, here you have 1, 3, 2, 0, 4, 5. All the first indices are different. And also they have different ranks because the second indices are all different here in this vertical line. And you have the same constant, for instance, for the lines. So this will be at the third table. There are officers with different ranks and different different regiments. And so you try to solve the problem, to arrange them this way. And at the end, you see that you must still put the officer 1-1 and the officer 0-0, but it's impossible. Because if you put 1-1 here, then it means that along this vertical line, there will be 2-1 for the first index, it's not possible. And if you put 0-0, you will have the same problem for the second index. So this is no solution, and Tari, around 1900, he has tried all these permutations in years, and he has shown it was impossible to solve the problem. And this is actually related to this kind of structure, but in dimension 6. And the impossibility to solve that means that you cannot find just 4 different directions that will fulfill the axioms that I mentioned before. And so this is why I hope that you will say to Hobbes-Perkins that you must not try in 6 dimensions this epistemic theory, because it will be a loss of time. It's impossible to solve the problem. No, that's all I wanted to say about this epistemic approach. It only works for certain dimensions. I think the global message, and that's interesting for physicists, is that in quantum information, not all dimensions are equivalent. Certain dimensions have a special role. And in this case, these are the prime parallel dimensions. And one could give a kind of physical interpretation is that the prime dimension will be like atoms of dimensions. And when I have a given dimension D, I can always decompose it like a product of powers of prime numbers, and this decomposition is unique. And there is a natural physical decomposition of my Hilbert space that I can associate to that, is that I can partition my space into products of Hilbert space of dimension pi, where I would have m times the same qp. And so this is a natural decomposition of my dimensions. And
the particles with spin 2.5.
For instance, it's so into 6. Yes, okay. No, so I would like to decompose it to 3.2.
I've asked Bill Wooters before why he spent so much time thinking about complete sets of MUBs instead of the symmetric information to complete the sync problem.
Oh, yeah.
Why does he spend so much time on the MUB problem
and his answer, I've asked it twice. His answer was Wooters.
Yes, okay.
And his answer both times was that, that he thinks maybe God likes the prime numbers.
Yes, that's. And that's one of the two that you used to come up.
And that's your conjecture here, God likes the prime numbers.
Yeah, I didn't think too much, but it's an
So what would you say are factors that, that ignore your rule here? So I
advise
you to lean in to use something other than prime factorization.
Yes, for instance, sick P of M, you can do in dimension 6, there is no problem. Yes. But it's not the same problem. Things are not related.
But often in problems one finds it convenient to just break up the Hilbert space any way that one can, depending on which operations they can perform. So they may not obey just a simple prime factorization.
No, there is no condition.
So you wouldn't call that a fundamental factorization of the Hilbert space?
No. I'm not sure that this is fundamental. I don't say that this is a law of nature, that those dimensions are particular. But it's something that I learned from mathematics, that all dimensions, from that point of view, all dimensions are not equal, are not equivalent. And I think it's interesting. I was puzzled by that result. I'm not sure it's fundamental. It's fundamental for this kind of technique. But for instance, for the Newt, nobody knows. Of course, there is no finite field with 6 elements, but there could be 7 newts nobody was able to find. Yes?
Similar discrete Wigner function techniques can be done in even dimensions and odd dimensions. So,
well, even dimension, even odd power dimension, it's only 2 to the power of n.
And then you have n qubits. That's what people usually use.
Well, this machinery that I described before doesn't work. But yes. For instance, in relation with the 6 POVM, there is a paper of Appleby where he defined all the Clifford transformations. I didn't mention that, but actually, the unitary transformation that lets you pass from one materially unbiased basis to another one, this is a Clifford transformation. And the Clifford transformation, they preserve the displacement operators. And actually, this is the essence of the covariance relation that I wrote here. If no, instead of the Bell states, I pass to the displacement operators, this tells me that when I represent the displacement operators up to a unitary Clifford transformation that lets me pass from one basis to another, from one mu to another mu, I will again get a displacement operator up to a phase. And this is the definition of the Clifford group. So all this is related to the Clifford transformations. And this you can generalize in arbitrary dimensions, yes. But it doesn't correspond to mu anymore.
Any more questions?